Prologue, The Game of Life, Austin, Texas, August 1975. "Where do you want to go?" asked the man who pulled over in response to my outstretched thumb. "I don't really care," I told him. "I'll go wherever you're going." And I hopped into the car. A grand adventure was calling me. I knew that much, even if my direction was unclear. I felt fearless, excited, and eager to be on the move to wherever I might end up. So much suddenly seemed possible. At that moment, the destination didn't matter. What mattered was that I felt more alive than I had in years, perhaps ever. I think I had on a pair of shoes, but I'm not at all sure I was wearing a shirt. If I wasn't, the driver didn't seem to care. After all, this was 1975 in Austin, Texas, and there was nothing too unusual about a hitchhiking, long-haired, shirtless hippie. Besides, it was summer and hot as hell. I had just turned 22 years old. The man behind the wheel shrugged good-naturedly. He was clean-shaven and dressed in a suit with a loosened tie, like he'd just left the office, and was happy to be heading home early after a day's work. "Well, I'm going home," he said, "so I guess I'll take you there." As the car pulled away, I rolled down the window and closed my eyes. The warm breeze caressed my face, and I felt the powerful reverberations of the past few hours still echoing in my mind and body. Had it really been just a few hours? It felt like a lifetime, and yet I knew that earlier that morning, I'd been pacing aimlessly in the kitchen of the small apartment where I lived alone. I had recently dropped out of school again. My college years had been characterized by a series of starts and stops, multiple transfers between Trinity and the University of Texas, a motley collection of elective classes punctuated by impromptu breaks to hitchhike around the country. But this time I thought I might be done for good. The academic life, with its prescribed programs and predictable outcomes, just felt too constraining to me. I loved to think and I loved to learn, but I was no longer willing to read books someone else decided I should read. I still took classes that interested me and audited others, but I'd stopped trying to get a degree. So much for my dreams of following in the footsteps of the teachers I admired and making a career in academia. That life was not for me. Now my only curriculum was my own curiosity, and the university library was my classroom. Piled on the kitchen counter were the books I had to show for it: Camus, Sartre, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Somerset Maugham, Leo Tolstoy, Hermann Hesse, Alan Watts, and many more. It's not that I was trying to be a rebel. It's just that I couldn't conform, not to the conventional track, not to my parents' hopes and expectations, not to the path my friends were taking, with all its upstanding purpose and predictability. Yes, I was getting older, and I understood from the concerned questions of friends and family that I was supposed to be getting serious about my future. "John, what are you going to do with your life? John, when are you going to finish school? John, what kind of future do you think you'll find in the library? John, when are you going to get a haircut?" I didn't have good answers to any of those questions. I had stepped off the marked path on which everyone I knew was still marching forward. They all seemed to be disappearing in the distance, and I was left on the side of the road. One friend was becoming a lawyer. Another was going to medical school. In my mind's eye, I could see their future: status, security, income. I knew the beats to that tune. I just couldn't move my feet to it. I wanted something different, more real, more adventurous, but I didn't quite know what that was yet. And even more disturbing, I didn't have people around me who shared that feeling. I felt misplaced somehow, caught between a life I couldn't live and a life I couldn't yet see. I thought of myself as a seeker, but maybe I was fooling myself. Heck, maybe that unseen life didn't exist at all. Maybe I was on a quest to nowhere. Anyone looking at my kitchen counter would probably have agreed with that assessment. Next to the pile of books stood a large collection of liquor bottles. No, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I'd been seriously considering becoming a bartender, so I'd been practicing making drinks for my friends. I liked the idea of presiding over some smoke-filled, dark-paneled establishment, dispensing drinks and wisdom in equal measure. Wasn't that the kind of thing that real-world philosophers and writers did? I imagined styling myself after the everyday heroes of some of my favorite philosophical books: Somerset Maugham's mystic taxi driver Larry from The Razor's Edge, or Eric Hoffer, the wise, people-watching longshoreman. The only problem with those figures, as romantic as they seemed, is that they were mostly loners. I didn't want to be alone. I wanted friends, a lover, community. Indeed, my longing for love and community had gotten so strong a few years earlier that I'd ended up joining an evangelical Christian group. It started with a girl, the most beautiful girl I'd ever known. It was just after my senior year in high school. Her name was Carol. She gave me stuff to read about Christianity, and I found it interesting. Carol and I developed a good friendship, and I converted to Christianity. In my first year at Trinity, I joined a Christian group called the Navigators. Their approach was less formal than the churches of my youth, more about spiritual authenticity and personal connection with Christ. I could relate to this more counterculture Jesus, and at first, I loved being part of the community. I knew that humans had spent much of our evolutionary history in small tribes or bands, and I felt like I understood for the first time that bone-deep joy of belonging, sharing a common purpose and belief system. And I learned something about myself as well. I could evangelize with the best of them, a skill I would use later in a very different context. Despite the upsides, my interest in a religious life didn't last. I was attached to the intimate bonds, but I soon found the dogmatism too restricting. It was my nature to ask questions, and the age-old problem of evil quickly loomed large in my rational mind. If God is good and God is omnipotent, how can evil exist? No one could give me a satisfying answer. Like many a college student before and after me, I eventually decided that traditional religion couldn't answer my questions, and I drifted slowly toward atheism. Around that time, one of my philosophy professors at UT, a powerful lecturer named Robert Solomon, introduced me to The Existentialist, hence the selection of books in my countertop pile. I found their confrontation with life honest and refreshing, and Solomon became a role model for me, someone I aspired to follow in a life of deep thought and existentialism. However, as I stared at the books and the bottles that August day, my mind darkened. Who was I kidding? I was no philosopher. I was just a 22-year-old college dropout. My old friends didn't get me anymore, and I hadn't made many new ones. In their mind, I wasn't on a new path. I was on no path at all. My parents were worried about me. I didn't have a girlfriend, and I didn't know how to get one. What girl wants to date a guy who asks questions like, "What do you think is the meaning of life?" before he asked her out to dinner? And besides, why would a girl like me? I didn't like myself that much. Even as I focused on that unpleasant truth, all the things I hated about myself began to flood into my awareness. It was at that moment that my gaze alighted on something sitting between the piles of books and the cluster of bottles, a small card the size of a postage stamp, inscribed with a jaunty red heart. It was a tab of LSD that I'd been thinking about taking. Why not? I thought. Maybe it will make me feel better. Surely I can't feel much worse. Wrong. Turns out, if you drop a high dose of LSD by yourself while filled with self-doubt, you're setting yourself up for a bad trip. As I sat there, I could feel the drug come on. It was strong. I'd done acid several times before, but this felt much more intense. My inner turmoil began to rise like the creek in a wet Texas spring. The whispers in my head turned to shouts. The self-criticism cranked up into self-loathing. A litany of my failures and inadequacies flooded my consciousness, like water swollen with dirt and silt and debris, as the dark and churning chaos surrounded me. I felt like I was being swept toward a waterfall, desperately clinging to a rock as the torrent roared around my ears. My God, how much did I take? How long had I been tripping? Was it ever going to stop? Would I ever come back? I looked at my watch. But time seemed to have stopped for me. The flood kept building, and my own capacity to hold back the inner tide began to falter. Exhausted, I felt my grip loosening, like fingers slipping on wet stone, but hung on tighter. If I let go, I would be swallowed by nothingness, or so it felt. The experience of the drug was pulling apart my mind, threatening to undo the very structure of my reality. The inner workings of my consciousness were laid bare, and I realized how my mind is constantly constructing the world I see and experience from moment to moment. Now, under the influence of this powerful chemical, it all seemed to be dissolving. Was any of it real in the first place? Everything was blending together and at the same time falling apart. Any semblance of inner coherence was gone. The rushing floodwaters grew stronger, and the precipitous edge of the falls loomed closer. I was scared shitless, but also just so tired. Tired of holding on, exhausted with the effort of trying to keep it together. Finally, my grip failed, and the inner tide overwhelmed me. I lost control, let go, and went tumbling into ecstasy. I don't know how long it lasted. Perhaps an instant. Perhaps an eternity. Time had ceased to exist. I had ceased to exist as any kind of separate self. All I was aware of was one consciousness, pure, ecstatic beingness. I had merged into that one so completely that there were no thoughts, no fears, and no emotions other than the bliss of complete release. At some point, I began to differentiate from the one, just a little, enough that I could think and reflect on what was happening. My first thought was that I had died. It was as if I'd gone through a portal and popped out on the other side into a different dimension. In this new reality, the sense of self that I was used to, the neurosis, the problems, the fears, the yearning, the frustrations, the hopes that felt so familiar and constant in my life, was just gone, nowhere to be seen or felt. My usual self, my ego, had vanished, and somehow the bottom had fallen out of reality. And what was left was this. Well, everything. This awesome, all-encompassing sense of oneness. I was it, and it was me, and I was there, and it was all, an infinity of one, no beginning, no end, no other, God, one, being. I laughed out loud with joy at the wonder of it. But as this awesome reality dawned, there was also a tremendous sadness. The realization came to me, the one is alone. There's ultimately no other, just the one, and the one can experience loneliness. It wasn't the kind of anxious loneliness I felt when I sat in my kitchen. It was a deep, pure singularity shot through with yearning. And that sense of yearning intensified and magnified until, bang, something like a cosmic orgasm overwhelmed me, and I was all the multiplicity of existence exploding into being. I began to realize that existence is this delightful dance between nothing and everything. The one being's experience, my experience, all of it, an incredible infinity of happening. Oneness exploding and expanding out, becoming everything. The cycle of existence from one to many and back again. Breathe in, breathe out. Life, death, creation. And again, bang. Somewhere in the midst of this revelation, I knew I didn't need to be afraid. No, it was more than that. There was nothing to be afraid of. Not death, not life. We're all just popping into new realities. Endlessly, another life, another transformation, another experience, another adventure. This person, this John, is experiencing the journey of life as a human being, and he's sharing it with others who are also manifestations of the one being. I was filled with a sense of release, of joyous love for all of it. The cosmic heartbeat pounded in my own chest, driving out any sense of being stuck or lost. I'm completely free. Free to be whomever I wish to be, and free to create whatever I wish to create. It's just eternal play, forever and ever. As the intensity of the experience receded just a little, and I began to become aware of my body and surroundings again, I felt an overflowing excitement, and my small apartment felt far too contained. I needed to get out into the open, under the vast sky, and explore. Which was how I found myself in a stranger's car with no shirt and no direction and no concerns about any of it. When the man pulled up outside his home in a quiet cul-de-sac just a few miles from my apartment, I thanked him for the ride and got out. He grabbed his briefcase from the trunk. "Have a good night, son. Take care." Standing in the middle of the driveway, watching him open the door and greet his wife, I wondered, what next? An idea struck me. I bounded up the walk and rang the doorbell. "Hey, would you mind if I made a phone call?" I asked when he opened the door, a little taken aback to see me again. "Sure," he replied with a patient smile, motioning toward the phone in the front hallway. I dialed my buddy Casey. "Hey, man, want to meet up at UT and play some pickup basketball?" "Sure thing. I'll see you there." I never showed up. I began to walk. The intensity of the trip was starting to wane, and I realized I needed to head back to my own neighborhood 2 or 3 miles away. As I walked, I thought about my life and about life in general. I had always been interested in trying to understand the meaning of life. It's just the way I'm wired, I guess. That's why I love the existentialist. They went straight to the questions that mattered. Still, there was a catch. There was something that bugged me, that kept me from fully embracing their worldview. Were they happy? It didn't seem like they were. Yes, there was something about the philosophical confrontation with the stark and uncaring universe that appealed to me. It seemed honest and authentic, and I appreciated authenticity. Maybe we had to face life without God. And yet, I couldn't escape the gnawing sense that there had to be more to life, much more. I wanted to live a life of depth and intellectual courage, but I didn't want to be depressed all the time. I also wanted to live a life of adventure, joy, and love. Maybe there really was more meaning in the universe than could be found in the minds of Sartre and Camus and my philosophy professor, Robert Solomon. These thoughts tumbled around my head as I walked the streets of Austin, heading home. As the sun sank toward the western hills, they took on even more urgency. After all, I just experienced the beauty of existence directly, or so it seemed. That sense of love and ecstasy was still vivid in my awareness. My atheist, existentialist self and all the angst and self-loathing that was connected to it seemed distant, an afterthought, another person's problems, another life entirely. Up ahead on the sidewalk, a man appeared walking toward me. He had blonde hair with sideburns and an impressive mustache. I quickly recognized him, Professor Solomon. He'd often told the class that he loved to walk the streets of Austin, and here he was. I quickly moved to intercept him. Professor Solomon, I called out. He didn't immediately recognize me, hardly surprising, I guess, since he'd only seen me fully clothed. But I pressed on. I'm a student of yours, I explained. He nodded politely. Professor, I want to ask you, I continued very earnestly, do you believe that your life has any objective meaning or purpose beside the subjective meaning you give to it with your own mind? He smiled somewhat wistfully beneath his mustache and was silent for a moment. And then simply and plainly he said, no, I don't believe life has any meaning besides the meaning we give to it in our own minds. But if you think life is objectively meaningless, I don't see how you could be very happy. My bluntness has always been both a virtue and a curse, but in this moment, I think it was a blessing that I found the courage to give voice to the one concern that mattered most to me without beating about the bush. You're right, he responded, looking me in the eye. I'm not very happy. I nodded, he nodded, and we continued walking in our respective directions. It was a short encounter, a brief, uncluttered, but profound exchange. And to this day, I'm not totally certain whether the conversation actually happened or not. Whether it was a literal event or merely an LSD-induced hallucination, whether I actually met the great philosopher on an Austin sidewalk and confronted him about his life and state of mind, or was simply talking to myself, I'll never know. It felt real, but I suppose it could well have been just part of the trip. Solomon died suddenly many years later while changing planes in the Zurich airport, on the very day that we had agreed to have dinner together. I had not seen him since my student days and was looking forward to telling him this story to see if he had any memory of it. But in the end, I don't think it matters. Real or not, the encounter was hugely impactful for me. Solomon was a role model, a man who represented a path forward that I was considering for my own life. And suddenly, I found it wanting, missing something essential. That seals it, I thought, as I nodded my farewell to the professor on the sidewalk and continued on my way home. I'm not an existentialist. Happiness, adventure, love, joy, purpose, creativity, play, community, these were the things I wanted in my life. Even as the intensity of the LSD receded in my awareness, I could still feel the buoyant echo of the experience speaking to me, communicating tacit messages from some deeper or higher place in my own consciousness. Messages that spoke of love. Love! Love is the most important thing in the world. That simple, glorious truth was wonderful to contemplate. And there was more. Another word jumped to my mind. Possibility. Yes, that's it. So much possibility. I'm free to create a life. My life. A wonderful life. My earlier sense of emptiness and having no clear path forward had been replaced with a feeling of openness and potential. There was so much I could do, and it felt close at hand. I had no idea what I would do or where I would go, but I was more confident than ever that the adventure of a lifetime was waiting somewhere nearby. As the last rays of the afternoon sun shone down on my bare skin, I felt ready for the next chapter. I was 22, unsure about pretty much everything, shy, socially awkward, single, still filled with questions and doubts, but the world was breaking open. It was time to get moving. The cosmic game of life was inviting me to play. I could feel the yearning building, and I couldn't wait to discover what I wanted to become.